Hello, everybody. Dr. Lonnie Stewart here from the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. Are you a physical therapy student about to start studying for the National Physical Therapy Examination? Or maybe you're a professor, a program director, or a clinical instructor who teaches DPT students preparing for the NPTE? Either way, we would recommend checking out our sponsor, NPTE Final Frontier, and the community they've built around preparing for and succeeding on the NPTE. That exam and the preparation that goes along with it can be long, tedious, difficult, and stress-inducing, but it doesn't have to be. NPTE Final Frontier has the tactics and resources to help address all of the usual barriers. They even have scholarships to help with NPTE study courses, FSBPT registration fees, and even research opportunities. And if that's not enough, they're even donating to the very first annual HET Podcast Scholarship to be awarded at the end of every year. Go to npteff.com for all of the details and use code HET for 10% off all purchases. Links to both the NPTE Final Frontier and their scholarship options are available in the show notes. And now, let's get ready to learn.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. F. Scott Feel, and I've got with me new friend, Dr. Eder Garavito. Eder, thank you so much for coming on today. I am super excited to share your story, as we share a lot of similarities in our journeys, in our backgrounds, our neurodivergence. I guess the first question is just tell us a little bit about your educational journey and how it's led you to where you're at today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Scott. I'm humbled to be on the podcast. My educational journey, honestly, there's a lot of, you know, kind of goods and bads, but ultimately it was a very positive one. Essentially, I'm a middle child, and my older and my younger brother always just really, they were great at school, got great grades. And for some reason, I always seemed to not get the best of grades, all the way from preschool to through elementary, through junior high, and especially high school, where I graduated with, like, I think a 2.6 GPA. And my educational journey, really, although positive, it always was a little bit difficult because I had a hard time finding my identity in terms of where I fit as a student and as a learner. I was called by many people, you know, stupid, dumb, lazy, etc. And eventually I believed those things. I believed that I just wasn't smart enough, right? So I thought, look, I'm just going to do as best as I can to just barely make it through, and we'll see what the future holds for me. Where in high school, many students are, after, you know, SATs and ACTs, they're already applying to colleges, and I'm sitting there thinking, I'll see what the future holds for me, right? Because, you know, we're not mature at that age sometimes, and we don't really plan things out, and that wasn't, of course, the best decision. So after high school, I went to community college, because I didn't apply to a big school and I probably wouldn't have gotten into a college. And I finished my Associates of Arts there. But the first part of my studies in community college really consisted of a pish-posh of things. I mean, I took business classes, I took biology, I took, what else did I take? I think I had like a cooking class, to be honest. I failed an English literature course just because I just didn't like to read, quote unquote, right? Don't like to read. And eventually, I like stereotypical story for many PTs, I did injure myself, tore my ACL, and I found myself in PT. And it really was an enlightening moment. And I thought to myself, this looks cool. What do I have to do to get there? And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed working out, and I enjoyed sort of like the personal training environment. And there was a career fair at my community college, and my alma mater was there. And I just talked to them, and I was like, this is what I want to do. And at that moment, honestly, I cannot think of a better example than the cliche, a light bulb click. And I was like, I want to be a PT. What do I need to do? And going from a horrible GPA in high school and a mediocre GPA in community college, I graduated with a 4.0 with all of my prereqs for PT school from now my alma mater, just because it was something that really interested me, something that I liked. And then the rest is history, PT school and such and the like. And then I've been practicing for about 11 years now. And I am in the dissertation phase right now of a PhD in teaching and education and learning sciences at NC State University.
I love it. Soon to be Dr. Doctor. So let's talk about this now. You and I both are in academia, right? Much like you, I struggled, you know, throughout my academic journey because we didn't fit the normal mold of, like, study hard, be a good student, like, you know, do all the right things. You know, I don't blame the school systems. I don't blame my teachers, you know, and at the same time, I also don't blame myself fully either, right? Because, again, we talked about this a little bit on the Beyond These Clinic Walls podcast. Go listen to that episode if you haven't. That should be out anytime now. But the school system was set up to essentially create employees. It is set up to teach people how to learn to do the work that companies need done, right? It goes all the way back to World War I, World War II type factory worker type folks, where we need employees, 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 right? We need people on the factory lines doing the jobs that we need them to do to keep the world moving, right? I just didn't learn well that way. I didn't learn well traditionally, right? And I think a lot of it was like, again, the neurodivergence. If you look back now, you know, the ADHD diagnosis makes total sense. It's like, oh, I see now why I struggled so much. But I was recently diagnosed, you know, so it, for me, it was more just like an unveiling, you know, like an, oh, yeah, okay, good to know. I'm still going to go about my day and do my thing, but you know, it's good to know that was part of the case, right? Despite all these issues, despite the journey and the struggles and the trouble, we've still made it pretty far in our journeys, right? We've had pretty successful careers, right? You know,
so
two
far,
doctoral
yeah.
degrees, right? That's not you know, too bad, not too shabby. Shifting from the clinical world to academia was like immense. It was ginormous. It was just insane. And people warned me about this, right? So let's get into the meat and potatoes of today, right? People told me, they gave me a warning. They said, it is a career shift. It is a giant change. You have to be ready for it. And I was like, ah, I'll be fine. It's no big deal, right? I've practiced for 15, 16 years. I know all the things. I can just show up and teach them the things, right?
Just tell them what you know, right?
Exactly. Just profess, if you will, right? Turns out that is not the case. Academia is a completely different beast. It is a job change and a career shift. Tell us about your experience with, you first get into academia and you just start getting hit with these waves of all the things that you just don't know about. You're not taught, you're not ready for. Like, tell us your experience.
Well, how much time do you have, Scott?
I got all day, brother. Go
yeah.
ahead.
No, I kid. So I was also warned like you, and I also just kind of brushed it off because internally, I just really, that's just something that I really enjoyed as a clinician practicing full time. Man, I went out of my way so many weeks, days, months to do travel teaching, contract teaching, adjunct teaching, you name it. I did everything in the book. And fortunately, my wife was supportive with that. But I think one of the biggest warnings that I received that I ignored, and that I hopefully your listeners can really take this into consideration, because burnout is a huge thing in healthcare. Don't pursue an academic position just because you're burnt out of your clinical work and because you just want, quote unquote, a change, because it is, like you mentioned, it is a shift beyond what I could have imagined, right?
Yeah, and burnout can be found anywhere, right?
Anywhere.
It can be found clinical, it can be found in academia, it can be found in entrepreneurship. Burnout is just a thing that exists everywhere. So
everywhere,
you're
exactly.
Not escaping burnout by switching to academia.
Right, right. But a lot of clinicians feel like that's just a good shift. Like, I want to try something new, let me go teach. And to your point, not only was it a huge shift, there are so many different things that we need to consider when we are, quote unquote, like you said, professing, right? So the shift for me was huge because internally I was like, well, again, I've been practicing for this many years. I have my board specialty and I am fortunately going to be teaching the courses that relate to my board specialty. Like, what's so hard about just telling them what I know and what I do, right? Now, in hindsight, if you think about it, the vast majority, I can't throw a statistic out there because I don't know it, but I can guarantee it's the vast majority of healthcare educators transition into academia as what we call a lateral entry, meaning they don't have any formal education on how to teach. You take a high school teacher, you take a college professor, you take even a higher education professor not in healthcare. They have gone through teacher preparation programs and apprenticeships and all these things, whereas we literally are like, hey, you know what? You got the degrees, you got the certifications, you want to teach, you meet the criteria, go.
It's just in the clinic when they put you in director of rehab or a clinic manager.
Yeah.
We didn't learn any of that stuff. You just assume, well, you know, PT, you can run the PT clinic, you know?
Right. So exactly. And so for me, I think the biggest thing that initially hit me was creating a course from the ground up. I don't think I ever want to ever open a blank PowerPoint presentation, knowing that it's the very beginning of creating a course. You know, for me, I'm about 5 years in, so I'm still sort of in that, you know, amateur, junior, faculty sort of space. To create a 1 hour lecture that what I think is good, that really is has great objectives, man, it takes me like a week, right? And then of course there's writing exam questions, which are even tougher. We cannot write questions just like identify this thing and identify that thing. I mean, they have to be good quality questions that have a great stem. They have all those sorts of things. As we shift away from that, I think what was the most surprising to me were the administrative duties that we have, right? So teaching is part of it, where you are teaching your students, but then those administrative duties sometimes are very, 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 very hard and time-consuming. Committee work, scholarship, faculty meetings, division meetings, advising students, addressing student performance, addressing internal and external conflicts, curricular design, all these things are very difficult. Now, in my defense, I did help bring to fruition the College of St. Mary's hybrid DPT program. So as a new faculty member also, I helped with writing our AFC and go through accreditation. So that was an experience in itself. So ultimately, I guess the message is, if you like teaching, you know, look at it, because if you're a good educator and you really like people and you like just sharing your knowledge, this could be a position that would be very good for you. But not everybody is a good educator, and this is just not for everybody, and that's okay. The thing of it is if you're you know, for lack of a better example, miserable in your clinical position, you might not be treating the patients in the best of your capacity, right? But you can switch from one job to the other. Whereas if you're miserable in your faculty position, now you're responsible for an average of 150 students that come through you, and you cannot let them down because they are ultimately your customer and their consumer.
Yeah, you touched on a lot of good points there. And I want to start from the beginning and just let people know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, but academia is essentially like a stool, right? It's got three pillars that hold it up, right? Teaching, service, and research, right? Those are the big three pillars of academia. And I didn't even know that going into it, right? Again, just assume that I showed up, I taught, you know, and I maybe went to a, you know, a couple of team meetings or whatever, right? And I don't think students even realize this. Teaching is like half, if not less, of our full workload, right? So while I may be teaching 2, 3, 4 classes, whatever it may be, that's a portion of everything I have to do. Like you said, there's administrative stuff, right? So the service is like service to the university, service to the students, service to the community, whatever it may be. And that can look like a bunch of different things, right? It can look like pro bono clinic work. It can look like student mentoring. It can look like boards and committees and chairs and all this stuff, right? The appeals committee, the admissions committee, the student wellness committee, whatever, you know, there's all these committees and things. And then there's task forces when things come up and you got to work on those, right? And a lot of times, like, you know, you're just kind of being voluntold what to do. Like, hey, you're sitting on this chair now. And hey, I need you to do this. Hey, you're an expert in this. Why don't you sit on this, right? And, you know, once we look at the big picture, right, and then we throw research in there and we're trying to do research and put that out based on where you teach and how much they, you know, put the emphasis on research, you have to figure out a ratio of all that stuff with your program director that works for you and works for them. And now you're like, okay, I've got all these things that I now do. What does that look like? How do I navigate that, right, in my new quote unquote 9 to 5, my job, right? Like, that's what I do in academia now, right?
Did you say 9 to 5? Just
yeah,
yeah, right.
It was in quotation marks. I use the air quotes at the very least, right? So, you know, and again, if we really want to get into the weeds, like I, you know, all of my teaching was done in a flex program. So it's like, you know, we're literally not 9 to 5. We are, you know, on call a lot, and there's evening, you know, tests and exams, and there's weekend labs, and there's, you know, questions that are being emailed to you at all hours of the night and stuff. And it's like, you know, I try to shut it off at some point, but you also want to be there and be responsive, right, and, you know, help people out too. So it's, you know, it's a different beast, right? It just is. So yeah, you're shifting from clinical to academia maybe. And that's, you know, if you're not a big fan of clinical, then maybe, yeah, academia could be an option, but I would strongly recommend, like you said, if you love teaching, try it out, right? Dip your toes in the water. Don't just go all in, you know, and dive head first without checking the depth, right? Dipping the toes in a little bit, right? Because I didn't think I liked teaching. I had my EDD and I was like, I'm burnt out on the dissertation. I'm going back to clinical, right? 2018, I jumped right back into clinical because I was so burnt out on the dissertation. So I said, I'm just going where I'm comfortable and where I know I'm good, sticking with clinical, right? And then COVID hit and the world changed and, you know, I went a different direction. But that being said, it's like, there's lab assistants, right? There's guest lectures, there's contributing or adjunct faculty. There's different ways. You could even teach undergrad to start with. You can teach at a community college, right? Like, they're always looking for people to teach these things and help fill in these things. Try those things. Get in there and just see if you really do like teaching.
Absolutely.
Because teaching is an art form. I mean, teaching is way harder than I thought it was going to be. So, And again, I was a pretty decent communicator just from all my life experiences. So like, I thought it would be way easier, but it's really not. There's a lot. And again, we'll get into this in a little bit, but you know, there's a lot that goes into the psychological science behind teaching and learning. And you know, you and I both went through the same issues where we just didn't know how to learn and what was truly learning until we were way down the line, you know? So let's talk about that while we're on the topic. What were issues that you had, or when did you realize like what true learning and then eventually teaching actually was?
So currently 37 years old, and I probably realized that honestly when I was like 34. But it's better late than never, right?
Oh yeah.
And I realized that when I started my PhD program and I started learning about teaching and learning theories. And I was pushed by many individuals to just sort of look at all my accomplishments so that I could really value them. And I was like, well, like I have done a lot, but it has been really hard for me, right? Harder than others. Like, why is it easier for that individual and things of the like? But I think, would I change my past if I could, if I would have identified that I liked learning a specific way? I don't know. I think it makes us stronger, right? It made me stronger of who I am today. And not only that, It helped me identify myself as what type of a learner I am so that I can identify what type of learners I have in front of me. And I can adapt to that, right? Because I can see myself in some of these people and I know how to adapt. And I know how to adapt to different learning styles. And of course, like you mentioned, it's an art. It comes with practice. Communication is definitely, it's highly, highly, highly important. And it really is the base of how you are able to profess, if you will, your information to the students. However, there's a difference between you and I able to have a conversation over a beer or coffee and communicate highly complex concepts well. And that's where it gets a little bit hairy, right? So for me, honestly, it was when I was in my PhD program and just reading about all these types of scenarios, learning theories, situations that just resonated so strongly with me that I was just like, why am I in a textbook? Like, this is me, right? And so I ultimately, like I said, I can't change the past. I didn't learn well in high school or in elementary or anything of the like, and I struggled to learn. And I think that the main reason that I struggled to learn, once, like you mentioned, not to blame the teachers and not to blame, you know, the system or the government, I just never really knew why I needed to learn those things. I was the absolutely worst math student. I could have told you I hated math my entire life, right? And then I have to take physics to get into PT school. I'm like, why do I have to take physics to get into PT school, right? Now I have to take this highly complex mathematical course. And I'm telling you, brother, when I got into physics, it clicked. I was like, this is real life math. Like, wow, like I can do this. I don't care about the Pythagorean theorem or all these other types of equations. Like, this is talking about things that are real life that happen in real life. And all of a sudden I started loving math because there was that connection and I knew why I needed to learn it.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I grew up, was a pretty good student in high school, fair student in college, rough student in grad school. And it's all because I was a rote memorizer, right? I thought reading and highlighting and reading and highlighting and reading and highlighting until it stuck in my mind and I memorized it, that was learning, right? And then I would take the information, do the test, do pretty well, and then dump it and then do it again for the next one. Yeah. So I just assumed that that's what was learning and that's how everybody learned and that's how everyone studied, right? Well, I get into an EDD program, and like you said, there's all these learning theories and all this, like, you know, teaching to those theories and all this information. And it just blew my mind. I was like, oh, this is learning. I have no idea what I've been doing my whole life. But like you said, would I go back and change it? Probably not, because having the struggles I had and working my tail off just to, you know, be as good as I could be, that showed me who I was and how I could cope and kind of, you know, deal with the, what at the time I didn't know, but the ADHD and, like, you know, the learning quote unquote disability, if you will, right? Like, I now have strategies to succeed this far into my life that I've used my whole life, because this is just what I had to deal with and navigate. And it works for me. Now, it's going to be different for everybody, but I know my strategies now. I know what works. And now I also know all these learning theories in different ways to, like you said, connect with people who might be like me, or who might learn a different way or another way or a third way, right? Like, there's all these options now. And I know that even though I've got my EDD, I'm still learning, and right. I love learning about teaching right. and learning. So I'm going to continue to learn, because again, that stuff really interests me and I want to try to be the best version I can be, you know? So it's not over. Obviously it's a journey, you know, but I'm glad that I'm where I'm at now, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, to go back to your rote memorizing example, I did the same thing, and man, I killed all of my anatomy practicals because I was like, I can memorize every single bone, body part, anything, but then it was gone. But Scott, like, I can say no for myself even in your earlier learning career, elementary, high school, junior high, whatever, until your EDD program, did anybody ever sit down with you and tell you, this is how learning should happen? These are the different learning strategies. Nobody ever tells us that. It's always just, here, you got, like you mentioned, you know, we're creating these employees. You got to go through the system. And nobody ever says, oh, you're doing really bad in my class. You have a D, but you're really engaged and you're really positive and you're really friendly. But why do you have a D? Let's look at how you're learning and provide you with a different tool. Nobody really does that. And not to blame them. I mean, think of all the people going through the system. I just don't think they have the capacity to do that.
Yeah. No, I mean, my dad was an English teacher, right, in high school for 30 some odd years, right? And he was a really good teacher. And I sat in on a couple of his classes and I just didn't like the kids and the students. I was like, these kids are jerks. I don't want any part of this, right? I would never be a teacher. You know, now here I am many years later teaching, right? Thanks, Dad. But I will say this, like, I never got told, like, hey, like, there's different ways to learn. Here's some options. Here's some things, right? And, you know, it again, I don't blame them. I don't blame my parents for sure. They pushed me to do well academically my entire life. And so I did. I just thought that's what you did, right? You go to school, you get the best grade you can, you go to the best college you can, you graduate and you get a good job, right? It's almost like we were sold the lie a little bit, right?
It's the American dream.
Yeah, right? Throw in the white picket fence and the 1.5 kids or whatever it is, 2.5 kids, and you're good to go. So I think the big issue for me is, like, I wish there were more options earlier on in school.
Absolutely.
Right. Like, we talked about this a little bit the other night, but like the Montessori schools, right? That to me is a little bit more useful and different learning style that makes more sense to me. And in hindsight, my parents didn't know. I don't even know that we had Montessori schools back where I lived, like, where, you know, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but like, that wasn't, they just sent me to like, you know, public school and then you go to college and whatever, right? Like my dad taught at public school. He's like, hey, it's fine. You'll be fine. I was like, all right. So, and even private school, like I took, there was a test you had to take to for placement in the private schools back in New York. And I took the test. I did pretty well on it. I had my choice of which school I wanted to go to. I was like, no, I'll just go to, you know, public school with all my buddies and stuff. So that's how the decision was made. It had nothing to do with like, well, what's your learning style? You know, what do you need to know? Where do you need to, you know, to strengthen up some areas? Where, you know, do you feel like you're a little bit weak? Where are you excelling currently? None of that went into the decision-making. It was just the, you know, follow the herd, you know? So now I would strongly recommend and encourage people to consider other options, you know, like try to get to know your kids, try to get to know, you know, like what their learning styles are, you know, try to figure it out. And nowadays we have a lot of testing. We have a lot of technology. There's some great things out there that can help you kind of analyze that stuff. You know, and homeschooling is becoming more and
Absolutely.
More popular. So
Absolutely.
Whatever works, you know, it's going to be different for everybody, but you know, whatever works.
You just talked about decision-making, right? And current inflation and mortgage rates aside, I mean, how many times have you perhaps, and I know that I just did it recently, and how many times do people choose where they're going to move based on, of course, the neighborhood, the people, the walkability, whatever, but they base it on how good the public schools are, the education system is, right? Everybody.
Yep, we did.
So it's a comfort thing. Well, I'm moving here. I can afford this home in this neighborhood. They have a good education system. So I'm just going to send them to public school. So to your point of Montessori schools and private schools, absolutely. But unfortunately, at its core, it's a privilege, right? Yeah. It's a privilege to go to those schools. So then therefore, it becomes a privilege to be exposed to these different types of tools. To the last part of your message was beautiful. Just if you see your child struggling, don't just ultimately point the finger at them initially. Get to understand what's happening, talk with them, help them help you understand why they're struggling in school before saying they're lazy or they're what have you, or grounding them or taking their phone away for bad grades, because potentially they're doing their best and they're doing everything they can and they're giving their all and they just can't get there because they just don't know how to get there, even if you move to a 5-star public school neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, the internet has made the world very small. It's given you a ton of options all at our fingertips, in our pockets. So, you know, there's a lot you can do to kind of start poking around and figuring it out. And I would recommend just try things, right?
Absolutely.
Taste tests, see what works. So, all right, let's shift a little bit and get into the big topic for the day. And that is things we wish we knew getting into academia, right? Like, there's things that program directors look for and that they wish that new entries into academia knew or you know, were competent in. And then there's things that we as clinicians or people looking to get into academia in hindsight now who have gotten into academia wish they knew, right? So what are some of your big takeaways as you reflect back now a couple years into your journey? What are some things that you wish you knew going into that transition into academia?
And now for a quick shout out to our newest sponsor, Varela Financial. If you're a physical therapist and you have student loan debt, you got to talk to these guys. What makes them unique is that they view financial planning like running hurdles on a track. And for PTs, the first hurdle many of us run into is student loan debt. Varela Financial will help you get over that hurdle. They not only take the time to explain to you which plans you individually qualify for and how those plans work, but they also take the time to show you what your individual case looks like, mapped out within each option. So if you're looking for help on your student loan debt or any area of personal finances, we recommend working with them. I use Varela Financial personally, and they were able to help me lower my student loan repayment from about $1,800 a month down to about $135 per month simply by finding the right repayment plan that best fit me, my family, and our life goals. You can check them out at VarelaFinancial.com. Link is in the show notes if you need it for reference, and tell them the HET podcast crew sent you. And now back to the show.
A lot of things. I think the first thing, and I'm privileged in where I work and how things work for us and how we designed our curriculum and our program, because I'm aware of how others work. But just speaking in general terms, I think that knowing from day zero that I was probably going to spend 15 to 20% of my time teaching and engaging with students, 30 maybe, and the rest was going to be what we already talked about, service, scholarship, administrative tasks. Would have been good to know, because ultimately I got into teaching because I just wanted to engage with students and I wanted to see them grow and I wanted to teach them, right? Now, all these tasks that we mentioned, they're not all bad. They help you grow as a person, as a leader, as an educator, in ways that you didn't even think you could, right? But knowing how I need, like the things that I needed to do to be a good educator beyond the learning theories and things of the like, to be seen, I should say, to be seen as a good educator and a good leader. And that includes, of course, scholarship, right? And a lot of institutions are different. I'm not in an R1 institution.
Yeah,
so my my scholarship is pretty flexible. Just knowing how I could fit in clinical practice as well, because I still see patients every 6 weeks or so, because I want to ensure that I know what I'm doing and what I'm teaching is up to date. And really knowing kind of who leadership is, who they are, how can they help me beyond my program director? Because your program director is I think kind of obvious. They're, you know, the director of your program and you can ask them for what have you. But there are people beyond that that can help you, like the president, the VPAA, like all these other people, and you just make connections within that, right? I think in general, I wish I would have understood the academic environment better. And that includes who is telling us and who is like keeping track of what we're teaching, right? What are our, like, who's keeping track of our outcomes? And that stems all the way back to like our CAPTI standards and things of the like. And then from there, instead of just developing a course, teaching my students, passing my classes, what have you, is what do I need to do as an educator to ensure that I'm meeting those standards? Because guess what? Whether it's 5 or 10 years, they're coming back. And I need to have everything documented and I need to meet certain criteria to ensure that I, in their eyes and in the eyes of my institution, in the eyes of my program director, I still meet that criteria to be a faculty member, right? And just knowing kind of like the support systems that are out there, really, because I feel like we're all get so drowned sometimes in academia and so busy that we sometimes don't talk to each other. But like you, Scott, you are a new connection to me and of mine. And I now know I can reach out to you if I'm drowning for something just for an idea, because you're brilliant. And I think a lot of people don't do that because of imposter syndrome. And we talked about that a little bit, especially as a new faculty member. Sometimes new faculty members join faculty teams that are well-seasoned, that have individuals that are very well-published, that are very well-known, and there's just like little old you, and you think and you're made to believe that on day zero, you're supposed to do all the things that they do. And ultimately, that's not true. My recommendation would be to have a very 100% clear-cut understanding of what are your duties and responsibilities that you have to meet, like on your first year, your second year, et cetera. Do as much as you can. We know we talked the other day about just becoming your better self and not competing with others. And then just identifying people. It doesn't matter how seasoned or not. They could be new faculty members like yourself. Identifying people with like-minded people with, you know, that share the same sort of beliefs and morals and everything that you can rely on. Because even though I teach most of the exclusively cardiac and acute care things, I rely on my ortho people because I love them, not for orthopedic knowledge, but for, hey, can you look over this course? Does this make sense? Does the series of how I'm presenting this make sense? Like, use each other and find people that you can help, that can help you and help them. They review my exams, I review theirs. And it's not always for content. It's more so for the presentation and things of the like. So you're not alone, but I think honestly, for many new faculty members, because it's such a hyped up position, because of there's a shortage and there's always going to be a shortage. Like, come join us. We'd love to have you. We feel alone a lot in the beginning, but you don't have to be alone. Just reach out to people, man.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack there. I mean, the first thing I think of is fit, right? Wherever you go to teach, it has to be a good fit for you.
Or right? You, exactly. Yes.
And my first, you know, experience in teaching wasn't a great fit for no other reason than, like you said, everybody was, you know, heavy hitters, well published, been doing it for years. And here's little old me in the middle of an EDD program, not knowing anything on how to teach and how to, you know, I'm just getting started. I'm, you know, literally like a new grad, right? Like a baby deer who was just born stumbling around the place. Like, I don't know if this is going to work out, you know? And it had nothing to do with them as much as it was just me, like, and my thought process on like, huh, I don't know that I fit in here. You know, this isn't for me, I don't think. Right. And then the next position where I went in full time was a great fit for me because it was people, some were very well published, some hadn't published at all. Some were 10 years into their teaching career, some were brand new, just like me. And it was like that dichotomy that like showed me that, oh, we all are on a team and we're all working together. And you can reach out and talk to these people about what they're finding and how to do these things they've done. And, you know, they're all very willing to help, and a rising tide raises all ships kind of thing, you know. So it made it a very good fit after that. And then also research, like you said, if you want to do research, if you're good at research, if you love research, R1 type universities that focus heavy on research and need that research and those grants and things like that are going to be maybe a better selection for you. So maybe start thinking of applying toward that direction. If you're not into research like myself, you know, you have to do it. Like it's part of, you know, just 1/3 of the things you do in academia. You then, you know, maybe not R1 research university is the way to go. Right. So like figuring those things out, right. Flexibility, like, where do you want to live, right? Do you want to go to a local state school and teach there? Do you want to teach at a PTA program, like at a local community college? Well, you know, if it's an on-campus program, you got to live somewhere near the campus, right? If it's a hybrid or a flex program, you may be flying in and flying out, you know, for labs every so often. You may be, you know, able to teach from home. If you're, you know, adjunct or contributing and you teach a completely online course, you may be able to live anywhere and just teach online, right? So like, all of these things that kind of go into figuring out what a good fit is for you, you know, it's things that I think we don't think about when we first want to transition into academia, and those questions and those conversations need to be had. And like you said, the easiest way to do it is just to reach out. Like, don't worry, like realize that everybody started at day zero at some point, right? So either you find somebody in the same boat as you, other day zeros that are looking to kind of get in, and what have you found and what are you hearing and where are you looking at, right? Or you use your network and you reach out to people that have been doing it for a while, right? Like, hey, I'm really interested in teaching. Are you guys hiring? What needs do you have, right? Like, hey, what should I do? Like, I didn't even know I had to change my resume to a CV when I first started, right?
What's a CV, Scott, right?
Right.
People don't even know that. And I did the same thing.
So I asked a handful of people. They all gave me examples. They showed me theirs. And I was like, oh, okay, I can make this work, right? And then, like you said, luckily, CAPD, our governing body there, has our, a template that you can kind of use to, like, make it look like all the others that they're going to look at eventually, right? So I just followed that guideline, and that was simple. And ever since then, I've just been updating it little by little and trying to keep it present. Like, now I know, right? But it's not something that I knew. It's like in that movie, A Few Good Men, right?
With, yeah, yeah.
Where Tom Cruise is like, well, you know, how did you, go to get lunch? Show me in the book where it tells you where the mess hall is. And he's like, well, it's not in the book. He's like, so you've never eaten a meal? And the guy's like, well, yeah, I eat 3 squares a day. Well, how did you know where the mess hall was then if it's not in the book? I just followed the crowd at chow time, right? Like, that's all you got to do, man, is like follow the crowd, right? You just kind of go where everybody else is going, do what everybody else is doing. And then eventually you get your feet under you. You start, you know, getting like some sturdy ground and foundation, and then you get to work, you know, and you start working on becoming the best version of yourself that you can, you know, and not comparing yourself to that guy who has 35 page CV, right? Not doing 150 publications. Like, you do what's right for you and what you love and what you're passionate about, because that will then reflect on your teaching style, right? Your educational style, your flow. And that trickles down to then the students, which hopefully get a better outcome because you're loving what you're doing. You got a good fit. You now know a little bit more about how to do it, right? And you're learning more and more on how to do it better. So that was my roundabout journey.
See, your take is as heavy as mine to unpack. With all those tasks, Scott, you know, the way that I think about things is, look, we're human and we only have X amount of bandwidth individually based on your individual life and demands. And we cut corners as humans, right? And it's just natural because we have so many tasks to do as faculty members. But my core belief and the thing that I will never let go of and I will never cut corners on is what I deliver to the students, because they are my customers. And not only are they my customers because they're paying a lot of money, they are going to be the ones that are potentially laying their hands on me in the future, right? So just like you're saying, like finding your path and your identity, just finding ways to prioritize tasks, but always remembering like the main priority that you have and the main duty that you have, which really is kind of sacred in some capacity, that they're trusting you to create, you know, through their minds, the most competent physical therapist. So just not forgetting that for me always keeps me grounded. Just like I'm doing it for them. Now, this other task, I can't do it. I'm going to push it back or try to cut this corner or collaborate, find people. But when it comes to the students, that's one thing that I'm always focused on.
Yeah. I mean, it just like when you're a clinician, right? Patient-centric, patient-first care. Same thing in academia. It's student-centric, right? Student-first care. And we're trying to do the best we can and deliver the best product we can, right? And that looks very different in very different ways from university to university. I don't think there is a gold standard. If so, we haven't found it yet. I think we're still trying. But, you know, at the end of the day, you do just want to help transfer knowledge so that those folks can go out and be safe practicing clinicians, so that when you get injured and they have to treat you, like you said, they're competent, you know, clinicians. They're somebody that you would want treating you or your grandma or whatever it may be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, Scott, I know I'm your guest, but I got a question for you because I'm so curious about this. What is your belief in, and you know, you and I are on the other side now, so it doesn't affect us, right? But I would go back in time if I had to. Like, what is your belief in implementing some sort of a barrier assessment course or preparation program for all clinicians who want to become full-time faculty members and not let them just transition from one day to the next without having any sort of, because I mean, my CV, I can make my CV look glorious and I can have an amazing interview and they can hire me because my personality is great and I'm a good fit, but how do they know that I'm going to be a good educator?
So here's the issue there. I think, especially with this new wave of all the experts and the you know, massive, massive celebrities in the world of academia that are now getting older and retiring, like you said, we're already at a deficit and there's going to be even a bigger deficit over the next 5 to 10 years based on just, you know, people getting older and retiring and you know, moving on from academia, right? Because a lot of times you get into academia after many years of a career first, then you go into academia. So you've already worked a bunch and then you're going to work a bunch more in academia and then you're out, right? So I feel like that almost puts up a little bit of a artificial barrier that doesn't need to necessarily be there. I think if teaching is your passion and you truly want to do it, there's ways to get more experience and reps. And that's what I think is more important than like a competency barrier or something like that, right? Because again, if we look at me, right, like I went through an EDD. I had my EDD by the time I was in the middle of it for my first adjunct teaching job, but then for my first full-time job, I did have a full-fledged EDD. I had a terminal degree, right? Well, that helps. That's a big benefit, right? Like you said, like if you have a specialty, a board certified specialty, that can get you into academia, that gets your foot in the door with a DPT. But if you really want to do it full-time, you're going to kind of have to look at some sort of terminal degree just to be safe and really give yourself a fighting chance, because CAPTI does want, you know, 50% of all faculty to have terminal degrees, which is arbitrary.
But you know what's wild about that? It's not only is it arbitrary, now they know it's arbitrary, so they're decreasing it to 40. I think they're voting in the fall. But you know what makes me upset about that demand, an arbitrary demand, is that they say like 50% of your faculty needs to have a terminal degree. A terminal degree in what? Because some terminal degrees are completely worthless for education, right? But as long as you have a PhD, DHSC, EDD, oh, you got a terminal degree. I think they need to, if they're going to quantify, they need to qualify it more.
Well, okay. So again, there's a whole nother rabbit hole here, but like, let's touch on that for a minute. A JD, right? A law degree is a terminal degree. And I've seen people teach with that, right? An EDD is an educational terminal degree. So like I can teach because I have a DPT but I have the terminal degree in education, so the two of them can kind of mix. I now know how to teach proficiently, and I know physical therapy proficiently, so that kind of makes sense, right? A PhD in education, same thing. A doc sci or a PhD or, you know, any of the other terminal degrees in rehab or bio or, you know, kinesiology or whatever it may be, those kind of make sense because they fit in. But like, yeah, what about, you know, a doctorate of healthcare business administration, right? That's a terminal degree, right? That's in healthcare business. Does that fit the bill? Does that, you know, public health, right? What if I get a doctorate in public health? Well, that kind of fits, right? That makes sense. That could fit, right? Well, what about a PhD in English? I have a DPT and a PhD in English. Does that
But on count? Paper, it's Does a terminal fit? Degree and it counts.
Yeah. So I, you know, again, I feel like it's kind of arbitrary. And the reason I say this, and I say this over and over and over again, but I've seen PhDs that are terrible teachers.
100%.
And I've seen DPTs that are amazing teachers. And I've seen DPTs that are terrible at research. And I've seen PhDs that are out of this world in research. So like, let them do the things they're good at and want to do.
Yes.
And then we can kind of, you know, learn and grow as, you know, we see fit along the way. And I think that's where the issue comes in there. If you set that bar of like, you have to have this residency or fellowship in teaching before you get into teaching, it's going to eliminate a lot of the possibilities, right? Because let's say you start as a DPT with an OCS or something and you're doing well and you realize, oh, I really love teaching. Okay, I pursued the EDD as like a backup plan. I was just going to retire by some little beachside community and teach one course at a community college when I retired. That was my EDD plan. And then COVID hit and things got crazy and weird. And I was like, all right, let's change it up a little and let's see if we truly like education or not. Turns out I do, right? So it's like, oh, I never would have known that if I didn't jump in along the way. But I got my EDD because I liked learning. It wasn't like an addendum, you know? It turned out to help out when I was applying for jobs then. But, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I want to teach. I have to teach. This is my thing. It was more like I'm a lifelong learner. I know I don't learn well. Let's learn how to learn better. So maybe that we could teach people how to learn better eventually, right? So if you put that kind of, you know, fellowship or residency or competency in there, I feel like you're going to dissuade a bunch of people that could maybe not even know they enjoy education and teaching as much. And like, oh, I got to take this whole other thing and this test, you know? And it's like, well, because once you're in the, let's say you enter in a program as a DPT and an OCS or something, right? And you're an instructor level. You can love teaching so much that you want to then pursue the terminal degree. And because you're working there full time, the university will help pay for it and fund it, right? Like, well, shoot, if they're going to give me money for, you know, a terminal degree because they need them, then by all means, let's get it paid for. Like, best education's free education, you know? So I don't know. I think we just, you know, I would like to see more bridge programs of some sort from like DPT to terminal degree so that there are more options for DPTs, because a DPT is a terminal degree. It's a clinical terminal degree. And yet we can't teach with that. Like, it makes no sense.
I mean, I think at its core, they probably just tried to standardize it in a way where it's like DPT is good clinically, but we need something else to like ensure that our educators are well-trained. But that point I'm trying to make is exactly like yours. Well, if you're going to demand a terminal degree from me, at least demand a terminal degree in X, Y, and Z that is fitting to my job from me, not some random degree that I got that now is on paper terminal degree. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. Like, if you're going to quantify it, then we need some defining points as to like, all right, you want terminal degrees. Give us more on that. Like, what fits and what doesn't? What works and what doesn't?
And that gives people that are hesitant about it the why.
Yeah.
Well, you need to get a terminal degree in these certain, I don't know, 20 different areas that are broad because they will ensure to us and ensure to you that you are going to be a proficient educator. That's the why, not just because you need to be 50% or else we're going to come in. Do I don't know what they'll do, to be honest.
Yeah. I I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too far, but like PhD in sociology, right? That's broad. That could fit. It's humans, right? It's not directly healthcare related, but I could see how it could fit, right? A PhD in economics. Does that fit? Does that work? I mean, healthcare economics.
On paper, it does to
hospital
Captain.
Economics, right? Yeah, it's got the letters, right? But how is that going to work? Is it going to, you know, are, and again, if you look a little deeper, CAPTI has some things like, well, why did you hire the person you did to teach the thing they're teaching? So if I'm teaching like the business and admin course with a PhD in economics, it kind of makes sense, right?
Right, right.
You can connect the dots, like, you know, but yeah, I mean, it right now it seems to me just very arbitrary. And I feel like we're running into some staffing issues in the
That's exactly what I was going to say, because a lot, if you look at a lot of job descriptions, pretty much like the second or third bullet point, if not the first, it says terminal degree required or highly, you know, recommended or what have you.
Yeah.
And that's going to, you know, assuade a lot of clinicians that might be looking at a position like, well, I don't have a terminal degree and it's going to cost me $50,000. It's going to be 5 years of my life. And I can't right now because of kids and stuff. So I can't teach. Well, my first recommendation in that capacity is, to be honest, reach out to the program director if that program interests you, because that could just literally be a copy and paste, and they might actually have more terminal degrees than needed than they could consider you. But the second thing is, I think that maybe those qualifications just need to be rephrased, because I think they're pushing a lot of people out that could potentially be amazing, amazing educators and that would be willing to get a terminal degree if they knew why.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. Well, Eder, thank you so much for your time and for coming on the show and just kind of sharing your story. We ask all of our guests this one final question. And that question is, if you could change one aspect of higher education, whether it be DPT or otherwise, what aspect would you change and how would you change it?
If I were to change one aspect in higher education, honestly, and this is to say, like, I don't want to get paid any less than I do in my salary, but if I had to, I would take the hit. I just really think that we need to reconsider the cost of higher education in the because that's not only like making it less expensive, because it should be less expensive, but it makes it more accessible. And the more accessible that we make that, those prices, then more individuals that potentially would be amazing clinicians, if we're talking about PT school, would be able to access these schools, and that would help us then continue to really gain more diversity in our profession, because there is not enough. And those prices are outrageous. I know we can talk for probably 3 hours of PT salaries versus student loans and costs. So in general, just really reducing those costs. And what is this crap about, like, if you're in-state, you get a 75% discount. If you're out-of-state, you don't. Like, just make it equal across the board. A student is a student is a student. It doesn't matter if they live there or not. So I think the cost is just wild. And definitely, definitely, definitely do not allow tuition hikes in the middle of a student's tenure. Like, the price they come in, that's what it is. And that's what you pay. If you want, if you're going to raise it or lower it, whatever, that's for the incoming cohorts. Not, you know, it's like kind of like you're paying your Netflix membership and all of a sudden they say, well, now you're going to pay this much. So prices are skyrocketing and they're way too high across the board, even for medical school. And I just think we need to fix that to just provide more access to individuals that have the absolute potential to be the best clinicians out there that would never have the opportunity because of the cost.
Yeah, you'll be happy to know that's the number one most given answer. But yours also had a little twist of accessibility on there too, which I like. You know, I think there's a million different issues at hand with the cost, and it's, you know, getting progressively worse, which is not great. But there's not like anybody to oversee that or govern it or like keep it capped somewhere. It's just they can do whatever they want. And over the years, as healthcare and education have become more and more of a business model, it's gotten pretty bad. So, you know, again, now we have to figure out how to make those prices worth what they're actually worth. So it's another issue, another hill we have to overcome, and another, you know, barrier we've got to break down. But at some point, we're going to start pricing out all of our future healthcare clinicians. They're just not going to do it because it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
economically.
And it's not too late to start. And to the price, to your point of pricing out people, consider social media, because social media wasn't a big thing before. And now everybody's talking about it. So all your potential students are hearing about students who are in the programs now saying, don't do it because it costs this much and you're only going to make this much coming out, and et cetera. Yeah. So it's not too late to start.
And again, when students who are interested in physical therapy come to me and say, oh, is it still worth it? Is the ROI still there? And I'm like, well, It is if you leverage it correctly, right?
Leverage
is the big word there. And there's a million ways to leverage it. And as long as we're showing them those options and teaching them that, and that's what I tried to do the business and admin course, like, you don't have to do these things. You can still be the clock in, clock out 9-to-5 therapist if that fits your financial needs and your vision and your plan. That's totally fine. Live within your means, you know, don't overextend yourself, make your salary, go home, call it a day. That's fine. But if not, there's other ways that you can leverage a degree in physical therapy. And, you know, we need to be doing that. So
absolutely. And those students that are listening to you are very fortunate because it's not often expressed in curriculum.
Yeah. Well, like I said, that's a whole nother episode for another day. Etter, thank you so much again for your time. Where can people reach out to you and find you if they have questions or follow up or just want to see what you're up to these days?
We're building up a company, a mentorship company. So just, you know, you can look us up at scholarnetics360 on all social medias or email me at egaravito@scholarnetics.com. And I'd be happy to share anything with you, I would be happy to share anything with your listeners that they would want to hear. Especially from somebody who's not 100% seasoned in academia yet. I'm still finding my way. If that is you and you want to connect and chat about it and cry together, let's do it.
Yeah. We'll put all those links in the show notes so people can find you very easily. Thank you again, Etter. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today, man.
Thank you, Scott.
Hello, everybody. Dr. F. Scott Feel here, and we don't do this nearly enough. I wanted to thank you as an audience for being here, for listening to the shows. Without you guys, we wouldn't have anybody to geek out with over education and learning and teaching and educating. So thank you for being here, for being, you know, faithful listeners over the years. Also, if possible, we'd love to ask a favor. We don't do this often, but if you could leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to this podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. It helps boost our rankings and our algorithm and really just helps get this message out to more people out there in healthcare education who may need, you know, some of the episodes and the experts that we interview. So if you could, like I said, leave a rating and review, we would greatly appreciate it. And we will see you on the next show.